warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance calling. Right here in North Central Indiana, near the P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and it is Thor's Day. Boy, I'd sure rather bend my knee to a mythical Thor than a mythical Hebrew, I'll tell you that. Yeah! Well, looks like we're going to have a nice one here in the north central part of Indiana today. Started out foggy, like on the tundra or over the swamps with a spooky fog. But it's gone now, and the sun's coming out. It's going to be a great day. Well, here we go with the pessimist's guide to history again. Today we go back to 218 B.C. Hannibal crosses the Alps. Rivalry between Carthage and Rome again erupted into war in 218, in what came to be called the Second Punic War. At its outset, the great Carthaginian general Hannibal decided on an ingenious and dangerous plan for attacking Rome. He would invade Italy by landing his 48,000-man army in Spain and marching through Gaul and across the Alps. Hannibal lost many men due to attacks of hostile peoples and during such natural difficulties as forging swollen rivers. But these troubles multiplied as he reached the Alps towards November, when the snow was already falling in the higher passes. Poor planning. Evidently, those people slowed him down fighting on the way over there. Hannibal's soldiers, all from the warm climes of North Africa. That's interesting. So I imagine it was a race-mixed group. Were either accustomed to nor clothed for the brutally cold alpine winter. Still, they began the treacherous ascent, leading pack horses, mules, and even elephants up narrow, icy paths. On the way up, thousands of men and animals fell to their deaths. Meanwhile, the Carthaginians also had to defend themselves against attacks by barbarian hordes, and they were probably mostly white. Near exhaustion from the climb and the cold, the Carthaginians began their descent on their 11th day in the Alps. But that same day they came to a spot where landslides had destroyed the path. Men and pack animals slipped and fell into the ravine below before Hannibal at last ordered the army make camp and rebuild the road. For 3 days the weary soldiers worked valiantly until finally the trail was repaired. Hannibal lost some 20,000 men during this now famous march, many of them in the final days in the Alps. He still commanded a formidable army, however, and soon successfully attacked Roman positions in Italy. This escapade is one of the early examples of the egotistical general hell-bent on victory, with equipment or without. Excellent idea about elephants, Hannibal. Well, there we go, and okay, let's go up to 217 B.C. for one more. No, we've got two more to go. 100 cities destroyed by a killer quake in 217 B.C. A deadly quake rocked much of North Africa in 217 B.C., demolishing 100 cities and killing more than 50,000 people. B.C. 2016, Hannibal decimates the Roman army at the Battle of Cannae. While Hannibal's Carthaginian army raged through Italy during the Second Punic War, the Romans assembled a massive army of 90,000 men to oppose him. The great Roman army finally met the smaller 50,000-man Carthaginian's army at the Cannae in southern Italy. Despite being outnumbered, the great general Hannibal remained confident of victory. According to Plutarch, before the battle, he remarked to his general Gisco, quote, In all the great number of men opposite, there is not one single one whose name is Gizgo, unquote. Incidentally, the blacks have picked up on this, and they claim that that Hannibal was black, and they even put out, a few years ago, they had an ad for Budweiser beer, I think it was, and they had a picture of Hannibal as a nigger. But in reality, there's stone carvings of him, statues of him, that obviously he's a white man. But I think he had a lot of non-white troops behind him because they came out of North Africa. By skilled maneuver, the Carthaginians managed to surround the superior Roman forces before they realized what was happening. The Carthaginians then closed in on the helpless Romans and massacred them as they stood in their tracks. Between 50,000 and 70,000 Romans perished in one of the worst defeats ever suffered by the Roman army. Only 6,000 Carthaginians died in the fighting. Only 6,000. Well, if you were one of the 6,000, that's a bitch. Hannibal's songs of victory ringing in his ears later sent back to Carthage 3 bushels of gold rings taken from the fingers of the slain Roman troops. That averages 20,000 dead Romans per bushel, or 5,000 per peck. So there you go, reading from the Pessimist Guide to History. I guess a lot of this pessimist stuff depends on which side you were on. If you're on Hannibal's side and against the Romans, it's not pessimistic at all. So anyhow, it all depends on who's getting gored. You know, I was reading in this book called Human Smoke. This passage here. John Cudahy, an American reporter, went to Birch's garden and sat at Hitler's large living room. Swastikas and paintings of nudes hung on the wall. There was a garnet-covered carpet on the floor. Cudahy noticed a bowl of hydrangeas and a vase of calla lilies. The bust of Wagner was still on the piano. Cudahy said, through a translator, the people in the United States were worried that the next logical field of German military adventure was the two American continents. Hitler laughed and he said, wrote Cudahy, the idea, quote, the idea of a Western Hemisphere invasion was about as fantastic as an invasion of the moon, unquote. Now, you know, they talk about it, Hitler, all the time, of course, in the media, and they keep saying he designed on ruling the world, and he was going to invade America and all that kind of stuff. It's all bullshit. There was a passage, too, about Japan. William Henry Chamberlain, a writer, spoke at the Keep America Out of War Congress that was May 31, 1941. A total economic boycott of Japan, the stoppage of oil shipments, for instance, would push Japan into the arms of the Axis. Chamberlain warned economic war would be a prelude to naval and military war. Taking these right out of the book from one page to the next, this is on oil. Walter Durante, a reporter, was back in Honolulu after a trip to Japan, and he had predicted, quote, every day I stayed in Tokyo, my conviction deepened that Japan would not fight unless she was compelled to by cutting off her oil supply, which they did. Durante wrote in the New York Times, a war carried grave risk. After all, the flimsy wood and paper cities of Japan would be shockingly exposed to incendiary bombs, he said. It was on May 26, 1941. And if you have got a good memory, it was Curtis LeMay, who was the running partner with George Wallace for president. He was running as vice presidential candidate. He's the one who was all hot to firebomb Tokyo. And, of course, they all wanted to firebomb civilian targets. They lie when they say they don't. They always do. And on Germany, remember, it was Britain who was bombing the hell out of Germany before Germany bombed the hell out of England. Lord Boom Trenchard asked himself what should happen next. For a year, the RAF had been unloading everything it had on the cities of Swart, to Kiel, to Mannheim, to Berlin, and it hadn't worked. No collapse of the civilian morale, no revolutionary unrest, no industrial taproot cut. Trenchard, beloved RAF, had lost many good airplanes and good men, and the men who made it home, interviewed after their flights, claimed they had blasted various objectives. Obviously, they hadn't. All they'd succeeded in doing was to make the Germans mad. And now here was the House of Commons roofless to the sky. It was the end of, evidently, the Germans bombed the House of Commons. It was the end of the May 1941. What next? Trenchard's answer was more bombing, relentless night bombing, heavier bombers, more bombers, no distractions. The English could take it, he wrote in a long memo. History has proven that we have always been able to stand our casualties better than other nations, he wrote. And the Germans couldn't take it. Quote, the German nation is peculiar, susceptible to air bombing. Yes, it was true that the percentage of bombs which hit the military target at which they're aimed is not more than 1%. That was only a problem if the military target was out in the middle of nowhere, like a battleship or an oil field. Ignore those targets. Ignore the French and Belgian coast. Ignore tactical operations in the Mediterranean. Drop more tonnage smack in the midst of Germany, where people live and where no bombs will go to waste. The 99% which missed the military target all helped to kill, damage, frighten, or interfere with Germans in Germany, and the whole 100% of the bomber organization is doing useful work, and not merely 1% of it. Any town with more than 5,000 inhabitants and some sort of military objective, which would not, of course, be hit 99% of the time, was fair game. Not a single day or night should pass without a visit from our machines, Trenchard wrote. The object was to break them, to make the civil population of Germany realize what war means. Bomb 'em. Bomb, bomb, bomb. When have we heard that before? Here's another brief one. The Royal Air Force began using a star system of air raids severity on July 5, 1941, as part of a summer offensive. The city of Munster received a 3-star blasting. According to the New York Times, it was raided again the next night and the next, and then the raid on July 9th got 4 stars. The works. The head of the bomber command, Richard Pierce, gave these orders. Quote, you will direct main effort of the bomber force until further instructions towards dislocating the German transportation system and to destroying the morale of the civilian population as a whole and of the industrial workers in particular. During the offensive, Churchill wrote a most secret message to Charles Portal. Quote, one of our great aims is the delivery on German towns of the largest possible quantity of bombs per night, he said. In order to keep up the pace of the attack, he proposed using what he called less qualified crews. They would fly very high, aiming simply at large built-up areas of civilians. Over, say, the Ruhr Valley, regular trained pilots would be used for more important missions. Let's see here. Okay, that's about it for that. I mean, this is a great book, this one I'm reading out of. You get a great idea of how evil these leaders can be, and when they worship these people and call them great heroes like Churchill and Roosevelt and all that kind of stuff, it's absolutely a lie. They're warmongering bastards, and they don't care anything about how many people they kill, any more than the military-industrial complex does today. Kill as many as you can, man. Kill them all. But if one Marine happens to let loose on a family of Iraqis in their house, that goes on forever in the news, which is also wrong, but they do it, while the guys at the top kill hundreds of thousands of people. One thing I think we should try to get straight on this Trump campaign situation and this Republican mess. is that what really we're coming up off with is this, and what we're, the real gains that we're making is free speech versus politically correct speech. All our enemies are on the politically correct speech side of things, and we're on the free speech. That's the thing we should push the most. That's the thing that Trump is doing, whether you like it or not, and whether you like everything he says or not. The point is that whether he is supporting free speech, saying what you want to say, and the other side want politically correct speech. So that's the war, and that's an important war as far as I'm concerned. Well, let's listen to a little bit of Jim Hightower, the populist, but don't get too excited over that democracy. There's never really been a real democracy, and it's certainly not a real democracy in this country, even though they keep talking about it all the time. Anyhow, let's listen to what he's got to say today, okay?
The price of liberty is said to be eternal vigilance. But just being watchful rarely does anything to stop the theft of our rights. Instead, the real price of liberty is open defiance, the courage to stand against the oppressors. And the price of that can be prison. Doug Hughes has dared to defy the corrupt plutocratic order that the moneyed elites, both political parties, and the Supreme Court have imposed over us. Dismayed and disgusted that we the people are blocked by big money from having our voices heard and responded to, this Florida letter carrier chose to get heard with one dramatic act of civil disobedience. In April, Hughes flew his homemade gyrocopter across Washington and onto the lawn of the U.S. Capitol to protest the usurpation of our most basic freedom, the right to be self-governing. This was no stunt, no spur-of-the-moment outburst, but a thoughtful, well-planned, nonviolent stand against the tyranny of money. Undertaken in the spirit of Henry David Thoreau and Martin Luther King Jr., this mailman on a mission was fully aware of and prepared to pay the price of civic defiance. Sure enough, on May 20th, a federal grand jury indicted this messenger of democracy on a mess of charges that could add up to more than 9 years in prison. Far from backing away, however, he's now calling out you and me. We spend billions protecting the United States from terrorists, Hughes recently wrote. It's time for Americans to spend time protecting democracy from plutocrats. This is Jim Hightower saying, one time when Thoreau was in jail for his defiance of authority, his friend Ralph Waldo Emerson happened by and asked, Henry, why are you here? Thoreau retorted, why are you not here? To be there with Doug in the fight to save democracy from plutocracy, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
Well, excuse that reference to Martin Luther King, and also the fact that democracy just doesn't work. And when he says we have to stand up to the system, there's only one way to stand up to the system that ever has worked at all. You know what that is. You know that these people out there, the white people especially, the reason that they're not doing anything is because they sort of like things the way they are. They got plenty of goodies. I mean, you know, they got Walmart, they've got Kmart, they've got Jewmart, they've got it all. And whereas they may bitch and moan, in reality, they're going to stick with the system. Stick with the predatory capitalist system and not rise up in any numbers at all. So if you're the kind of going to stand up and expect the people to fall in behind you and then attack the system, do something to the system, forget it. They really lie to you. They like it the way it is. If they didn't like the way it is, or was, is, they'd do something about it. I mean, do something about it. I mean, not the bullshit, not the voting, not to put in Trump or anything like that. That's all a waste of time. It can be a lot of fun and laughs, but it's not going anywhere. It's always been the eternal struggle of the working class or the regular people, regular white people, against the ruling class. And they say, oh, that's class warfare. Of course, it's always been class warfare. The rich have controlled the system, and the only time the poor ever get any place is when they cut the throats of the leaders of the system. I mean, whether you like it or not, that's just the truth. That's the way it is. Because if you stand around waiting for the ruling class to enforce your rights and equality and all that, that's bullshit. It's total bullshit. So if you're still in that playpen, that's called the playpen, you better get out or just have some more pablum and go back to sleep. Why do you think the corporate press are so upset with Trump? Well, they realize that even though it may not be too much, it could get away from them. They always have this thing, the fat cats don't sleep too well sometimes at night because they're saying, what would happen if enough of these people rose up and slit our throats? And it could happen. And when somebody like Trump throws all this stuff around, whether he means it or not, the ruling class start thinking, circle the wagons, baby. Circle the Supreme Court. Circle the federal courts, because watch it. They can be dangerous. And like they found out in the French Revolution, once it starts, whoa, Katie, bar the door shut. There's a man under the bed. Well, let's see what Max Kaiser's got to say about China, a mixed bag that we owe a lot of money to. So let's listen to Max here.
China, you believe almost the exact opposite of nearly the entire investment community on China. Tell us about it.
I think China's a basket case waiting to blow up. China's importing a lot of commodities. They're producing a lot of goods and services that the Chinese economy can't afford. The people in China aren't buying. They're producing these things for export at a time when export demand is shrinking in both Europe and the United States. That's not a good thing. They are pumping money supply like mad. Money supply in China is running about 30% a year annualized. The biggest rampant supply of money growth anywhere in the world is happening right now in China. They're building malls. They're building entire cities. They are building condo complexes that no one can afford, and these places are sitting there vacant. So eventually, this has to stop. China's keeping this going right now, hoping that the global economy picks up, but all the signs that I see in the United States and Europe, in Spain, in Greece, in Portugal, in Ireland, in Italy, suggests that consumers are not ready to pick up the spending. China's a disaster waiting to happen.
And you write that trillions in RMB loans are now going bad. What will happen to the banks in China?
It's hard to say the exact state of the banks over there, other than we can say the banking system is insolvent globally. Certainly the United States banking system is insolvent. I believe the UK banks are insolvent. I think the banks in Ireland, in Iceland, those banks we know are insolvent. Everyone somehow thinks that this command economy in China is okay. When the big difference there is, when the Chinese banks say lend, the banks lend. And the lending doesn't have to make any sense. But it'll keep on going as long as the government says for the banks to lend. Here in the United States, some point comes along, and we hit it, where it stops. And in a command economy, it doesn't. So China's overheating. They're going to have to cut back. When they cut back, there's going to be riots. So, or mass disruptions. Unrest, political unrest that China does not want to see. So they're in between a rock and a hard place right now, and I don't see an easy way out. And yet, capital money is flowing into China because of its so-called, you know, GDP that's going up. But China counts GDP differently than the rest of the world. When China spends money, it doesn't matter whether it produces any goods from that or not. it immediately goes on the bottom line as an increase in GDP. So China's money supply is going up. GDP is going up, whether or not any of that's malinvestment or whether or not it's producing anything at all. It's hard to say.
You bring up China's money, which, of course, is the RMB. Now, much of the ongoing friction between U.S. and China arises from the demands by the U.S. for China to revalue the RMB. What do you think will happen if RMB floated freely?
That's a good question. What will happen? First off, they're going to resist, but the U.S. ought to be careful about what it's asking for. If China revalues, if China floated the yuan, first off, there's no guarantee that the renminbi or the yuan, as it's locally called, would rise. What's happened is hedge funds have poured a massive amount of money into China that's sitting there in these Chinese banks that they're just waiting for this reevaluation to occur. And when this reevaluation occurs, they're going to pull all of this money right back out. That's actually one reason why China needs to keep all those reserves that it's keeping. You know, people, you keep hearing the statement, well, you know, why doesn't China do something smart instead of sitting there holding on to all of these dollars? You know, why don't they buy oil? Well, you know, no one ever bothers to ask, well, what is Iran or Saudi Arabia going to do with those dollars? I mean, eventually those dollars have to come back home. But technically, China needs to hold those dollars because the hedge funds and other investors are holding this money over there in China, waiting for this reevaluation to pull this money out as soon as this happens. So here we have this deadly embrace kind of thing where everyone's betting on the renminbi to rise, and the United States is putting pressure on China to reevaluate upwards, which is causing more money to flow into China to take advantage of this. And once they raise, it's all going to exit, and we're going to see this crash. So we are building to some sort of, you know, crash scenario here in the renminbi.
And yet, speaking of crash scenarios, the two biggest economies in the world, the U.S. and China, appear to be engaged in a beggar-thy-neighbor trade war, very similar to what happened during the Great Depression.
This is exactly a beggar-thy-neighbor kind of scenario. But everyone's doing it. It's not just China. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in the U.K. But the deadly embrace is U.S. and Japan and U.S. and China. And it certainly is. I mean, the U.S. is begging China to, U.S. wants to weaken the dollar to increase exports, and China wants to do the same thing. And, of course, so does Japan, and so does Europe, and so does Germany, Iceland, everywhere. You know, Japan's in a hard strait because of their aging population and a demographic. And they are selling, their population has finally reached a point where they're no longer savings. Their population is so aged that they have to cash in on all of these bonds. The pension funds in Japan are now net sellers of Japanese treasuries. So we have all of these things coming to a head. We've got a huge property bubble in Australia that's ready to blow up. We've got a property bubble in Canada that's ready to blow up. We've got property bubbles still that are have already blown up in Spain that are causing unemployment to be hitting 20%. In the United States, we've got 10 or 11 million people that are unemployed, looking for a job, that want a job, and I don't see it. I don't see any source of jobs. We've got these entire global confluence of problems that are all coming to a head all at once, you know, and on top of that, we've got massive union and pension problems here in the United States that are starting to make the United States resemble what is happening right now in Greece.
You mentioned pension problems. The baby boom generation, of course, is beginning to retire. Or trying to. Didn't governments around the world essentially promise citizens great retirements without the need to save?
Oh, absolutely. And that is yet another problem here that's really severe in the United States, more so than anywhere else in the world. We have these huge pension promises that have been made, mainly to the unions, and taxes keep having to rise to support those unions, yet there's so actually very few people percentage-wise in these unions. So you got taxes going up on the non-unions to support the few that are getting these luxurious benefits. Everyone else is hurting. And the average person that's not in union without these benefits thought that they had enough money saved up in their retirement or thought that their home would be their retirement, neither of which is true. So now you have a very serious issue of all these people that we expected to be retired can no longer afford to retire. So we've got senior citizens who are now effectively competing against their kids and grandkids for jobs. You can see it when you walk into any Walmart. You can see it when you walk into those kinds of stores. Just look at the age, the average age of the person, the greeter at Walmart. Is that person working because they want to be working, or is that person working because they have to work? I think to an extent, a lot of it is the latter. So this big burst of boomers that everyone thought was going to be retiring now isn't, and they're competing with kids coming out of college that are coming out of college $200,000 in debt or more with no job. They don't have a job. They're moving back home. Apartment rents are falling. This is the massive deflationary scenario that I've been talking about, that the next leg down of it, I believe, is starting now, or if it's not starting now, it's going to soon start. Meanwhile, we have Bernanke, we've got Geithner, we've got all these people talking about this recovery that's coming, and they're saying, well, it's weak. Well, there is no recovery coming, and it indeed is weak, and it's far weaker than what these guys are admitting or know. It's hard to say whether they're lying or they're just stupid.
Okay, Mitch, that's all the time we have for. Thanks for being on the edge.
Well, what else does this point to? Remember the Depression? Well, I was born in 38. Depression had been going on for ever since 29, and the economic indicators in 38 were no better than they were in 30. A lot of people don't remember that, and they don't know that. They don't study that. The only thing that got the United States out of the Depression was war. Yeah, the military-industrial complex of the day, they got us into World War II, and that got us out of the Depression. And then by bombing the hell out of Europe and Russia, taken out of the game by being on a stupid economic system, not even NEP that Lenin wanted, but like that. So anyhow, that's what led to our great middle class rise in this country. The great industrialization, because everybody else had been bombed the shit out of, their factories and everything else. They lied to the people about that. They say, oh, well, it was just sort of a miracle. It was just sort of a miracle. Yeah, it was a miracle. You blew the shit out of all the competition. So then people had to come to the United States to get their goodies. So anyhow, now what are we going to do? Now what's going to do? Do you ever hear a right-wing racial leader talking about economics at all? I don't know. Maybe they do, because I don't get to listen to them all. But you hear David Duke talking about this kind of stuff? No, they talk about race. They talk about the Jews. They talk about stuff like that. But they don't ever talk about something that's equally and maybe in some ways more important. That's economy and money and banks. They keep saying, well, the Federal Reserve is run by the Jews. Well, that they're so simplistic. This is too simplistic, because we have several generations in this country that have learned to act like Jews. Ever since the War of 1848, in Europe that was suppressed, and all those Jews kept pouring in here from Europe. That's when it started. And those were the people that, that helped win the war for the North. They couldn't possibly, the North couldn't have won that war without massive influx of European immigrants coming into this country and massive numbers of Jews bringing capital and bringing bodies in. And so now they've been screwing up our system ever since, of course. So anyhow, here we are. Everybody's looking at China like they're Mr. Daddy Warbucks, but it's all built on clay. It's all built on clay. Now, if we got out of, in which we did get out of the Depression by waging war and killing everybody we could kill, now what's going to happen? Because we've been at war in one way or in one form or another ever since 1941. We never stopped. We never got really out of war, so we've been on a war budget ever since 41. So now what's going to happen? What's going to pull us out of a depression now? How much more war can we support? Ask yourself that. How many more countries can we invade? How many more weapons can we sell? Well, I think that part of it's almost over. $1 trillion a year in tax money for the war machine. I mean, you know, this shit has got to end. It's got to end, and it's going to end badly. So when I run the clock here, tick tock, tick tock, tick tock, it's getting more like tick tock, tick tock, tick tock, closer and closer. So you better save some money, cash, gold, silver, or stuff like that. I mean, you better have some put away, because this thing could happen any time. You got a preview of coming attractions just last week with that China 1,000 point dip, wasn't it? And it could have kept going. So they, it's going to happen. Probably it'll start there, and then it'll just go around the world, and everybody will be out on the street selling apples again like in the Depression. Ask your right-wing racial leaders and your Hollywood Nazi leaders about this stuff. See what they say besides, duh, it's the Jews, it's the Jews. Yo, baby, yo, baby. Dear Mr. Metzger, whoa, let me get my, shouldn't make any difference on this mic. I got my snowball mic on now, and it's not directional like the other one. The other one's a good mic, but it's very directional. Dear Mr. Metzger, thank you for all you do. A couple of years back, I believe it was your former News and Views section, there was a PDF of a hand-to-hand lethal combat manual from somewhere around World War II time period, written by an American. It was one of the most badass hand-to-hand manuals I ever read, and I did not finish reading it and forgot to save a copy of it. I was wondering if you knew who may have written it or where to find it. Well, I'll tell you, we'll look around. I'll have the webmaster look into it. I'm not sure which one you're talking about. The reason News and Views is gone is because Bob, what was his name? Wall Street, we've separated and went our separate ways. He did a great job on some of that stuff, and it's too bad that things had to come to the point where it did, but I can no longer, well, anyhow. He went his way, I went mine, and so there's no more News and Views. I just don't have the time to put it together. If someone else out there wants to pick up the slack and put News and Views together, I'd be more than happy to reinstitute it. Also, P.S., I really enjoyed the News and Views section you had on your site and wish you would bring it back. Yeah, we just commented on that. I also noticed other content had been taken off. Jume's journal was quite entertaining, yes, but Jume's journal was way too conservative for me. I'd had to edit it quite a bit because Jume is more of a conservative right-wing guy. Some of his stuff was good, but I admit that. I understand you have to make a living, but I can't afford to send you any money right now. I would still like to develop myself into the best Aryan I can be. Thanks for your consideration. Well, first of all, I say anybody that can't send any money in is lying, because everybody could send in $5 or $1 or even a small amount of money. And I want to let you know I'm not living off this money. We put most of it goes back out in the form of books and so forth to people. It maintains our equipment, the things, our projects we're into. So if I had to make a living off what's donated to me on this an email, I would be starving to death, believe me. If you want to talk to people about that kind of stuff, go to David Duke and some of these other outfits that obviously take in a lot of money, a lot more money than I ever took in. And the reason I don't take a lot of it in is because I say what I think and I don't back down. I mean, you know, people tend to say, well, if I give you money, I want you to agree with me. Well, I can't promise you that. So the people that do help support us here, they know how I am. And they may disagree with me some of the times, maybe half the time, but evidently I'm doing something right because I'm still here. They say people smoke, they drink, they run around, they buy all kinds of Chinese shit, and then they say, I don't have any money to give you a donation at all. And like I say, that's a lie. That's a lie, because there's people that I donate to, and I dig down and send in $5 or $10 for somebody I like what they're doing. So don't give me that stuff. Somebody got me mixed up with my friend Carlos Porter. We're friends. I've known him for a long time. In fact, he used a lot of our A. Wyatt Man cartoons in his new book. But somebody in Korea sent me an email, said they recently visited his website, which is www.cwporter.com/letter44.htm, and he said, and was quite surprised to find your maps of Korea and Japan still described as Korea's East Sea, as a Sea of Japan, which is incorrect. Such an error on such a well-known website such as yours comes as a surprise, since we regard you as one of the world's best. That's Carlos Porter. Using the proper name for the body of water between Korean Peninsula and the Japanese archipelago is not simply a question of changing the name of a geographical feature. It is a part of the national effort by the Korean people to erase the legacy of Japanese imperialism and to redress the unfairness that has resulted from it. It is an absolute mistake to hear just one side of the story and to blindly follow. If we leave these kinds of things alone, it causes serious problems that disturb the order of the international society. For your reference, National Geographic, the world's largest commercial map maker, the world's largest commercial map maker and travel guide, Lonely Planet Publication, promised us they would now use the name East Sea. In addition, National Geographic and Lonely Planet are already using the name East Sea on their website after we pointed out the error. Well, the problem is the average American just is not geography oriented. I mean, you know, the East Sea or the Japanese Sea. This gets into this nationalism stuff, and it can get pretty hairy. So anyhow, I'm sure you pass this on to Carlos Porter, and he can respond to it. But as for me, I don't deal with that particular body of water enough to really talk about it. You know, these mullahs over there in Iran are always doing this. He's saying they're going to wipe out Israel and all that kind of stuff. That's just hype. They do that all the time. And actually, the hardliners in Israel love it. Netanyahu loves it when an Iranian says, we're going to wipe out Israel. Well, I don't think there's any plan or any possibility of wiping out Israel by Iran. First of all, Big Brother United States wouldn't stand for it. We'd risk the lives of every person in our military defending that bandit state. But every time these mullahs get up and give a speech, it's the way they keep their people together. These are the hardliners, and they do that to keep their people in line, you know. So anyhow, that's sort of funny in a way, but it's dangerous also. Hey, T.T., I camp in a Walmart parking lot. A German man and woman touring the Northwest and so on pulled up. I tried for 30 minutes to make every pro-racist point I could make. He said he was a history teacher. I argued that the Jews killed millions of Northern Europeans to install non-Jew history. Jew non-history. He put up some resistance, but nothing like the garbage Americans do. I'm not sure if that's good or not. I even offered them a place to sleep in my RV. He said, no thanks. Interesting, however. Well, I see the Christ Insanity people are making a big bid here in Indiana to infiltrate the schools. Child Evangelism Fellowship held recruitment camps in Indianapolis on July 13th to the 25th. Their goal is to start Good News Clubs in Indianapolis K-6 public schools. Good News Clubs meet on school premises after school hours for Bible lessons. In 2001, the Supreme Court ruled in the Good News Club versus Milford Central School District that the adult-led Bible groups be given the same access to school facilities as any other non-school-related group. AU filed an amicus brief arguing that allowing such meetings would violate the Establishment Clause, but the court disagreed by a vote of 6-3. On Sunday, September the 20th, at 6 p.m., Indiana AU and CFI Indiana are bringing the journalist Catherine Stewart to Indianapolis to talk about the tactics the Good News Club uses and what parents should look out for. I think there's one of those outfits out here on Highway 30 that goes by that name, Child Evangelism Fellowship. I'm going to have to go out there and investigate this thing. If you leave them a crack in the door, man, they're going to get in there and brainwash your kids. In 2009, the Good News Club came to the public elementary school where journalist Catherine Stewart sent her children. The club, which is sponsored by Child Evangelism Fellowship, bills itself as an after-school program of Bible study. But Stewart soon discovered that the club's real mission is to convert children to fundamentalist Christianity and encourage them to proselyze to their unchurched peers, all the while promoting the natural but false impression among the children that its activities are endorsed by the school. Astonished to discover that the U.S. Supreme Court has deemed this and other forms of religious activity in public schools legal, Stewart set off on an investigative journey to dozens of cities and towns across the nation to document an impact. In this book, she demonstrates that there is more religion in American schools today than there has been in the past 100 years. The movement driving this agency is stealthy. It is aggressive. It has our children in its sights, and its ultimate aim is to destroy the system of public education as we know it. Very interesting. Well, I thought this guy that shot the two reporters was probably black, but they lead you almost to believe he was white. In fact, I heard one news report say he was white. Well, Vester Flanagan, the reporter who went by the name of Bryce Williams, is the subject of numerous media reports today. Flanagan is being accused of killing two fellow journalists on the air in what has become one of the saddest tragedies to befall modern media in a very long time. No, the big tragedy is when they lose money. People they can replace. Shortly after the shooting, Flanagan shot himself to death after being chased by the police. Well, let's see here. This magazine's reporting that the shooting may have been the result of a significant racial frustration that Flanagan has experienced over the years. Yeah, he's a nigger. Flanagan reportedly sued his former bosses back in 2000, claiming that he was verbally abused by his employer. He even says that he was called a monkey on the job. Well, I notice on all the news reports, I'm not seeing any picture of this guy. Why is that? Maybe some of you have seen his picture, but I have all the reports here in Indiana. It seems like he doesn't, they don't have his picture. Wait a minute, I've lost my place here. Flanagan also accused one of the crew members he killed of being racist against him. Another lawsuit Flanagan filed against WTWC-TV in Florida stated that he was attacked because of his race. Here are some of the things that Flanagan said he experienced. Now, let me see here. What's this all about? Claims a producer called him a monkey. Claims an official joked about his about a black murder suspect with gold and green glitz, saying he had collard greens stuck in his teeth. Claims he heard a manager tell another black employee to stop talking Ebonics. Flanagan filed numerous reports on racism and says he was fired for blowing the whistle against his former employers. The case against WTWC was settled out of court back in 2001, and the companies denied any and all allegations. Well, they probably gave him a pot full of money, though. Tell us what you think. Is racism in the workplace a serious problem for you? Not for me, baby. Not for me. Well, I'll bet old Trump needs this like a hole in the head. KKK leader David Duke officially endorses Donald Trump for prez, tells audience to support the Donald, trying to ride in on his shirt tails. Former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke, you know, he'll never live it down, no matter how many years he lives. Former, we're all going to be former something. Has given his endorsement to Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, known for his hardline and racist stance against immigrants. They're not immigrants, they're invaders. Trump has won the support of several white supremacists since announcing his candidacy earlier this summer. Duke is the latest of these such endorsements. You see, this is a mistake. The right wing always make it this mistake, because they're so anxious to get on the list and get involved, get something, get some press. The way to do it is don't endorse him at all by white supremacists. Leave it alone. I'm telling you, if you really want to help the guy, don't endorse him. During his radio show, Duke said that Trump was the best choice of all the presidential candidates. I praise the fact that he's come out on the immigration issue, Duke says. He's an entrepreneur, and he has a good sense of what people want to hear and what they want to buy. Yeah, he knows how to hire illegal aliens, all right, and pay them very little. I mean, come on. And I think he realizes that his path to popularity towards power in the Republican Party is talking about the immigration issue, he continued. And he has really said some incredible, great things recently. So whatever his motivation, I don't give a damn. I really like the fact that he's speaking out on his greatest immediate threat to the American people. Well, Duke, if you want to help him, don't back him. Jeez. Yeah, and then it goes into all the stuff about the SPLC and Duke and all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, he's an ambulance chaser. David Duke is an ambulance chaser. And along with a lot of other right-wingers. I'm glad I'm not in the right wing, man. I'm glad I'm not in the right wing. If you look into all the crap that Trump has pulled over the years, you wouldn't want to be closely associated with him. you know, behind the scenes and whisper around maybe to vote for him, but in reality, he's not, his morals are not up to my standards. On his radio show, Duke says there's a problem of Europeans in the Western lands being being screwed over. But hey, wait a minute. Why don't you say white people, Dave? Just say white people. It's not going to kill you. European-American bullshit. A lot of people in Europe don't want to be included into that title. But why do these right-wing racial conservative gurus keep avoiding the word white? White working class. And they're poor European-Americans. Bullshit. I thought this deal where Trump threw the Mexican out and then brought him back and told him when he could speak and that was good. Let's hear some of that.
Okay, who's next? Yeah, please. Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Go ahead. No, you don't. You haven't been called. Go back to Univision. Go ahead. Go ahead. Sit down, please. You weren't called. Go.
I got the picture on here. The guy's tossing him out.
Yes, go ahead.
Got it.
Yes. No, I wouldn't do that. She actually should be apologizing to me, but I would not do that, no.
So they eventually let the mestizo back in, a loudmouth bastard. That was one thing I really liked about Trump. Well, boys and girls, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the bunker. And remember, I have nothing to say. Equality is a perennial fraud. Rights are a perennial fraud. Remember that. If you have any questions about it, ask me. Very simple. If you have a right, if you had a right, it could not possibly be taken away from you. Tell me something that can't be taken away from you. Absolutely ever taken away from you. Anything you have can be taken away from you.
Tom Joad got out of the old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come walking down the road. Poor boy, Tom Joad come walking down the road. Tom Joad, he met a truck-driving man. There he called him a ride. He said, I just got loose from McAllister pen on a charge called homicide. A charge called homicide. That truck rolled away in a cloud of dust. Tommy turned his face toward home. He met Preacher Casey and they had a little drink, but they found that his family, they was gone. He found that his family, they was gone. He found his mother's old-fashioned shoe, found his daddy's hat, and he found little Muley and Muley said they'd been tractored out by the cats. They'd been tractored out by the cats. Tom Joad walked down to the neighbor's farm, found his family. They took Preacher Casey and loaded in a car, and his mother said, we've got to get away. His mother said we've got to get away. Now the 12 of the Joes made a mighty heavy load, but Grandpa Joe did cry. He picked up a handful of land in his hand, said, I'm staying with the farm till I die. Yes, I'm staying with the farm till I die. They fed him short ribs and coffee and soothing syrup, and Grandpa Joe did die. They buried Grandpa Joe by the side of the road, Grandma on the California side. They buried Grandma on the California side. They stood on a mountain and they looked to the west, and it looked like the promised land. That bright green valley with a river running through, there was work for every single hand. They thought there was work for every single hand.